Okay, Rabotai, let's get started. We're on the Ches Amud Beis, and we're trying to analyze the machlokes between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. Rabbi Meir says in Motzi Shemra, we require how many judges? Three judges. So the Chacham require
23.
And the Chacham seem to indicate that we have a case here of dini nefashos, which means that if witnesses will testify that she had this nus during the Erusin period, Haktav, then she's put to death. That's a capital crime, and therefore we have to be well prepared in advance, and we have to have a court that could judge a capital crime, and hence we need a bezin of chav gimel. Now, yesterday we had four new explanations of the machlokas between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. Let's quickly review those four explanations, and that's going to carry us from Ches Amud Beis over to Daf Tes Amud Aleph. The first explanation of the four is that we have machlokas about Hasra here. Now, the way we understood the orchestration of things, the two witnesses came into Beis Din, and we had now three judges. And even though they're testifying on what could be a capital crime, but nevertheless, Beis Din is allowed with three Eidim to investigate these Eidim, interrogate them, and decide whether we want to move on to the next level and add 20 judges in order to try this woman for a capital crime. So now the Beis Din, sitting with three judges, interrogates the Eidim. And the first question they ask the Eidim, in order to determine whether or not there's a possibility of a dinei nefashos, is what kind of hasra did you give this woman? And the answer that they got from the Eidim is, according to Abayi, asru bei stam. We told her that if she doesn't desist, and if she goes through with this terrible crime, she will be put to death. That's called stam. And they failed to mention exactly which misa of the four misas bezin she would get. And according to Rabbi Yehuda, quoted here on the bottom of Daf Ches Amud Beis from the Braisa, Rabbi Yehuda says that ad sheodiwa eza misa, they have to, in order to fulfill the requirements of Hasra, they have to warn her about which particular of the four categories of misa she would be subject to, in this case, skila. Having omitted that, there's no possibility of taking this case up to the next level, namely, and making it into a capital case. So at this point, the only thing that we could judge is the monetary issue, whether that means they have seda ksuba, whether it might mean the knas. That's according to Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Meir adopts the sheet of Rabbi Yehuda. The Chachamim, on the other hand, assume that any Asra will do as long as the Asra indicates that this is a capital punishment. They don't have to, the Eidim don't have to specify exactly which Misa she would get. Then we had Rav Papa yesterday. I'm just reviewing, highlighting. Rav Papa also puts the machlokas between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim into the context of Hasra, but a different issue in Hasra, not the issue of whether Hasra stam or achiyodiu b'ezem misa, but rather the issue of what's called a chaver, or in this case a chavera. A chaver is someone who knows the law. Hence, according to one opinion, and we're going to see that this is the opinion of the Chachamim, there's no need for a Hasra. We can completely circumvent the need for Hasra. The Chachamim understood, and this is the opinion of Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, and the Braisa, that the purpose of the Hasra and the need for Hasra is lahavchin bein shogeg lemezid, which means to make sure that the criminal is aware of the fact that the action that they're about to engage in is a violation of the Torah law. Otherwise, the person can claim, Mutta, I thought it was okay. And that's called a shogeg. In order to guarantee that the violator is a mezid and not a shogeg, the hasra is necessary to establish that fact. And that only applies in a case of a rank and file citizen where we're unsure about their knowledge. But if you have someone who's on a higher level and they have the status of a chaver, which means they're a baki, they know the law, in such a case there's no point to requiring asra. If the purpose of asra is lahavchin bein shogig lemezid, and in the case of a chaver, or here in our case a chavera, he or she knows the law, you don't have to praise them of the law. They cannot claim the fifth. You know, they can't claim ignorance. Whereas Rabbi Meir identifies himself with the sheet of those who debate Rabbi Yossi and require a hasra even in the case of a chaver, meaning that the hasra has another purpose and it's an absolute requirement in order to condemn a person for death. There's no death penalty according to these shitas, which would be Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim that argue with against Rabbi Yossi. There's no way of applying the death penalty unless there was Asra. Period. Don't tell me, well, let's find out if they knew the law, they didn't know the law. Asra is built in as a precondition to the death penalty. So let's now analyze according to Rav Papa the machlokas between the Chachamim and Rav Meir. Rav Meir maintains that there's no way, after we interrogated the Edom and the Edom admitted that there was no Asra, there's no way that this case could become a capital crime, because Rav Meir understands that in all circumstances the absolute requirement for condemning a person to death is Asra. And when I say the absolute, I mean even in the case of what? Of a Chaver. Whereas the Chacham say we can already upgrade this case to a death penalty case, meaning to a capital case, because since she's a chavera, there's no need for hasra. Hasra is only la'avchin ben shogig l'meisi. Then we have the third approach. That's Rav Ashi, and this takes us over to Daf Tes Amud Aleph. Rav Ashi says that the machlokas here is about the nature of malchus. We're not talking about misa. We're not talking about accepting these edim in order to condemn this woman to death. Because in fact, the hasra was a hasra for malchus. So the two edim said to her, if you don't desist from this crime, you should know you can get 39 lashes. In such a case, she's in violation of this hasra, and therefore she will be subject to 39 lashes. But kamiflagi, what's the machlokas here? This is the machlokas between Rabbi Yishmael and the Rabbanon, which is the Mishnah here at the beginning of Masech the Sanhedrin. When you have a decision made by the Beis Din on any avera that would generate malchus, how many judges do we need to issue a ruling that the accused is going to be lashed? Do we need a Beis Din of 23 judges? That's the opinion of Rabbi Yishmael, because Rabbi Yishmael elevates malchus to the case to the same status as misa. It's basically a kind of a capital punishment, which means that malchus is already the beginning of misa. Any physical punishment is considered like a mitzas, a partial death. Or do we accept the shita of the Rabbanan of Rabbi Yishmael, insisting that anything but an absolute condemnation to death, a capital crime, requires no more than 3 judges? Only in the case of a capital crime, according to the Chachamim, do we require 23 judges. Now we understand, in the light of Rav Ashi, the machlokes between Rabbi Meir and the Chacham. Rabbi Meir says that since we're dealing with a malchus situation, Rabbi Shmuel is correct, and you need a basin of 23. According to Rabbi Meir, the Chachamim of Rabbi Shmuel are correct, that since we cannot condemn this woman to death because the asra was only for what? For malchus. Therefore, all we need is a basin of shlosha. The Chachamim accept the opinion of Rabbi Yishmael that malchus is upgraded to the status of misa, it's a miklas misa, and therefore we require a Beis Din of 23. And finally, the last thing that we covered yesterday was Ravina. And Ravina says that the machlokas here is a machlokas about Eidus, not about Hasra, not about malchus, but about Eidus. And this is based on the pasuk in Dvarim, Parshas Shoftim. It says there, Al Pishnayim Edim O Shlosha Edim Yumas Hames. And the Mishnah in Masechta Makis wants to understand, why did the Torah feel compelled to add the words O Shlosha? Once you tell me that two witnesses are enough to condemn a person to death, I don't need a third witness. So on that we have a sheet of Rabbi Shimon, which is mentioned in the beginning of Masechta Makis on Daf Hey. Rabbi Shimon's opinion is that the Torah equated Shlosha to Shnayim to tell us a kula, a leniency, in the law of Hazama. So let's go over the law of Hazama for a minute. We have the second pair of Edom, the Mazima, who say to the first pair of Edom, you couldn't have possibly testified on this case because at the time and at the place you were with us elsewhere. Not at that place, at that location to have seen the crime, but at that moment in time you were with us far away. And now the Torah says about the first pair of Edom, they become Zomimim, V'asisim lo, kasha Zomim lasos liachiv. But that only applies, according to Rabbi Shimon, if we could be mazim all three witnesses. So let's say you had a kat, which is a group of witnesses made up of three, and the second pair of Edom, the mazimim, said about two out of the three, Manu Ayisim, you were with us in a different place, but they have nothing to say about the third witness. So you and I would say, well, let's apply the din and the punishment of Asisim Lokashizom to the two witnesses. No. Says Rabbi Shimon, the Torah went out of its way to equate two witnesses to three witnesses to teach us that you have to be mazim, the azam has to apply to all three witnesses. It's an all or nothing proposition. Are you familiar with that? All or nothing? Does that? Yeah, in Yiddish it's called adagar, adagarnished. And here in Israel they say o akol, o lo klum. Every country has its own way, an own language of formulating it. It's all or nothing. It means that if you can be mazim all the edim in the kat, then it's hazama v'asisim lo kasha zoma. If you left out one of the witnesses, then that witness will salvage, at least as far as the din of hazama is concerned, all the other witnesses, and they become alleviated from their status as edim zomim as far as the punishment of kasha zomim is concerned. That's according to Rabbi Shimon. Comes along Rabbi Akiva, and he says no. The equation of Shnayim to Shlosha is not a kula to increase the requirements and upgrade the standards of Hazama such that we're lenient now, because if you don't reach those high standards, there won't be Hazama, and the Edom Zoma will be alleviated from their punishment. No. The Shlishi is coming Lahachmir. And here Rabbi Akiva says, what's the Chumrah? And he analyzes this both from a halachic perspective and from an agadic perspective. He has an agadita here. From a halachic perspective, it's telling me that if three witnesses testified in sequence, in chronological sequence, you and I might have said, well, the third witness is different than the first two. He's called a nitfal. Why is this third witness different than the first two? He's unnecessary. He's unnecessary. We could have issued the exact identical ruling with two witnesses. So he's just adding, you know, he's adding fuel to the flame, but he doesn't really become part of the essential kat of Eden. And therefore, in such a case, we're not going to punish the third witness, because he has a right to say, well, I didn't add anything. I'm a nitfal. I'm totally superfluous. You had legs to stand on with two witnesses, and you didn't need me. No, the Torah says the third witness is going to be subject to the same punishment as the first two witnesses in a situation of hazama, and v'yasisim lo kasha zomam, which might mean a death sentence to this third aid, is going to apply. So the equation between two and three is to teach me that the law of hazama, the punishment of hazama, all the chumrah, all the stringencies of the weight of responsibility falls not only on the shoulders of the first two witnesses, but also on the shoulders of the third witness. And now Rabbi Akiva makes an agadic statement, and here's where we want to pick it up today. That's where we didn't have time yesterday to finish up Rabbi Akiva. So if you're on Daf Tes Amud Aleph, I'm going to tell you where we're up to, and we're going to count up. Let's see, it's a small daf, so we can, you know, we're in the middle of the page, so we can either count down from the top or up from the bottom, whichever way you want it. Let's try counting up from the bottom. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay. And he says the following. We now come to the conclusion, says Rabbi Akiva, that on Ashakosim Zanitfali Ovri Averika, Ovri Avera. We see that the Torah punishes a nitfal. Nitfal means someone who's a tag on. I mean, after all, the third, you know, we used to say when I was a kid, two is a couple, three is a crowd. You remember that? So the third eight is really a crowd here. He's not part of the original odd couple. And therefore, you would say that the Torah could have been more lenient with the third eight. No, the Torah is very harsh. And it may mean that the third eight will be put to death if the Azoma will apply to him as well, even though he's only a nitfal. He's only a nachshleper. I mean, we don't need him, really. Right? That's called a nitfal. We have the Avera, and the Eidus is complete and reliable without the third witness. Right? He's just a crowd. He's not part of the couple. No. He's part of the couple. Oh, if that be the case, says Rabbi Akiva, I can derive a kal vachomer for what's called a nitfali osei mitzvah, which means if you're about to perform a mitzvah, but you could use a little extra support, a little extra help, you know, maybe it's heavy, you know, you're carrying something that's very heavy, and I will add a little. Again, you could have carried it yourself, but I'm gonna egg you on, so to speak, in order to make it smooth and easier for you to fulfill that mitzvah. I'm called a nitfali osei mitzvah. What would be the schar, what would be the reward in heaven for someone who's only a nitfal yosei mitzvah? You might say, well, the mitzvah would have happened even without him. You know, he's just adding a little bit of extra weight and encouragement, but he doesn't deserve a full-fledged reward. Comes along Rabbi Akiva with the kal vachomer, and he says that if the Torah is harsh with the nitfal yosei avera, over avera, then how much more so? The Torah is going to be very generous and magnanimous and bequeath and bestow a great reward on a nitfal yosei mitzvah. Now, what is the basis for this kal vachomer? How do we know that whatever applies to an avera, and the Torah now is being very harsh in the case of a nitfal avera, and he might have to forfeit his life for being a nitfal liovrei avera. How do we know, therefore, on the flip side, on the positive end, that we're going to be so bestowing and, you know, showering unbelievable rewards on even a nitfal liovrei mitzvah? How do we know such a thing? So the answer is based on a pasuk in Chumash. The Torah says that notzer chesed la lofim. That when God is bestowing chesed, this is in the, Yud Gimel Midas HaRachamim in Parshas Ki Tisa, it says, Notzer chesed la'alofim. Alofim means for 1,000 generations. And when it comes to punishment, the Torah says, Al shileshim v'al ribeim, that the punishment will only impact up to 4 generations, but not beyond the 4th generation. Again, that's only if those 3 generations in between are guilty, what's called Oksim B'maisa Voseim. Okay, we're not going to go into that now, but let's just get the mathematics here. The ratio is 4 to 2,000. What is that equal to? 1 to 500. So we're talking about God's compassion and chesed on behalf of Osei Mitzvah is 500 times greater than his midas ha-din and justice in punishing a violator of the Torah. Unbelievable. The ratio of schar to onashir is 500 to 1, or 4 to 2,000. Unbelievable. Says Rabbi Akiva, is therefore I come to the conclusion that alachas kama v'kama yishalem sochar, God will bestow reward as a nitfal yosei mitzvah ki yosei mitzvah. Because the Torah considers someone who is in a supportive role to be absolutely great, absolutely fantastic. And I'm thinking now of a Gemara in Sota. The Gemara in Sota asks the following odd question. Again, it'll sound odd to our contemporary ears. The Gemara asks, Noshim b'may kozachyan, women who are not obligated in the mitzvah of Torah study, how do they get schus? How do they get merit? And the Gemara answers, because they play a supportive role. What they do is they send their husbands out to the Beis Medrash, they send the children to Cheder, and they're going to do whatever they have to do in order to keep the house functioning. Today, in our time, it's mind-boggling. The women go out and they work, and they support their husbands. Again, I'm not telling you whether I'm in favor of it or not. I think there are a lot of issues here, but I'm from the older generation, so we were from the generation we were brought up to work and earn a living. You don't ask a cash on me. I mean, what about me? I don't seem to be working and earning a living, right? I mean, I might collect Social Security, but just like the basic level of me. But I get schar batola because I have an undergraduate degree, I have a graduate degree, so they pay me bupkis anyway.
Times two.
But you see that this concept of a nitfal li'osei mitzvah is a very, very fundamental question, very concept, and the reward of someone who plays a very a behind the scenes role is an incredible schar. I mean, imagine in the case of an avera, the third witness who doesn't really add much, he might lose his life because he decided to join the bunch. And he's a nitfal li'ovrei avera, and the Torah is going to be so harsh with him. You could begin to imagine the kind of a schar when you multiply this by 500 on the flip side of somebody who's a nitfal li'osei mitzvah. Okay, all that is just an introduction to our sugya for today, and now we're ready for our sugya for today. This is the famous statement of Rabbi Akiva, which is going to be subject to a major, major debate. There are two interpretations of Rabbi Akiva, and that's going to lead us to a new light on the machlokas between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim about Motzi Shemra, and whether you require 3 judges or 23 judges. Says Rabbi Akiva, Umash Naim. In other words, this Hekesh has to go all the way. Now, until now, we've been saying that the status of the third witness is equal to that of the first two witnesses. For example, he's subject to Hazoma. Now we're going to say that the third witness is going to shed a light on the status of the first two witnesses, because that's a Hekesh, it's a two-way street. Nimta Echad Mehem Karov Oposel. We find that one of the witnesses is a Karov or Apostle. Now, what's a karov and what's a posel? A karov means, in the broadest sense, a relative to anybody. What do I mean by anybody? Everybody's related to somebody, right? But what I mean is, he could be related to the other witnesses. He could be related to the plaintiff. He could be related to the defendant. It's even possible that he might be related to the judge or one of the judges. In all those cases, he's considered a karov, and a karov is excluded. So the first case that I gave you is where he's related to another witness. Can you imagine that Moshe and Aaron come to testify, and the testimony is disqualified because they are kroven? Now, why do I emphasize this? If some people think mistakenly that psule edus, that disqualifications for testimony, is a matter of what we call chashash sheker, that we're afraid that they may perjure themselves and we can't rely on them. I deny that totally, because Moshe and Aaron are disqualified for testimony despite the fact that we have no question that they're testifying truth and not falsehood. And there are many other examples that I could give. So karov is called a psul haguf. Okay, I'll write that on the board because I think that's an important concept here. Psul haguf. Now, the opposite of psul haguf, the flip side, is what's called chashash meshaker. And all of the laws of edus and all the intricacies and nuances of the laws of testimony and who qualifies and who don't, they all hinge on this distinction. Two different categories. There may be a category which is intuitively logical. That's called a chashash meshaker. A person has vested interest. Why should we trust their testimony? Mm-hmm. And then there's something that is totally out of the realm of logic. It is simply based on law, the way the law operates. It's what we call a gzeiras hakasav, a divine decree. And that's called psulaguf. For example, a melech, a king, does not qualify for testimony. Not because we think he's lying, but because the Torah apostles are melech. In the case of a woman, she's technically not capable of giving edus, again with certain exceptions, and that would also come under psulaguf. It's not that a woman is less trustworthy than a man. But then we have cases called nogea b'edus. Okay, nogea b'edus. Which means that the witness has something to gain from his testimony, has personal gain at stake. What's it called? Conflict of interest. And in such a case, we have what's called a chashash meshaker. Now, let's say I could prove to you that in a particular set of circumstances, his testimony would not benefit him at all. Then he might be reinstated as a kosher aid. So, for example, I have a whole sugya about what's called an arev, right? An arev. Arev is someone who takes a arev, right? Not erev, but arev. Right? He signs as a security. How do you call it in English? A guarantor?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll call him a guarantor. Now, what happens if he wants to testify in the loan? He's not really front line in the sense that the Malva can't collect money from him. He's only in a default situation. But that also might come under Nogea B'Edus. So that's what we're dealing with here. Now, Karov, meaning a relative, that's a classic case of psulaguf. As I told you before, you can have two people that are related to each other. They're absolutely trustworthy and reliable. We have no reason to believe that they have any vested interest in fabricating the truth. And yet, they're disqualified. We cannot accept them. That's the case of a karov. Now, if you take a look at the Mishnah in Makis that we're studying now, that's quoted here on our daf, we have something called apostle. What is the case of apostle? I understand that somebody is disqualified because he's related. But now you have another category called apostle. Who would fit onto that category? And Rashi, unfortunately, says nothing about this. He doesn't tell you who this apostle is. So I'm going to suggest the following possibility. Let's say that one witness who's not related to anybody comes into Beis Din on his own. He becomes posuliatus, which means that even if at some point in the future a second witness would come in, since the second witness did not join hands or forces with the first witness, he could not be considered part of the kat, which again in fancy language is called chisaron siruf. Okay, the word siruf, even in modern Hebrew, means to conjoin. When you get together two to form an entity, a unit, that's called siruf. And for a kat of witnesses, again the key word here in Asugi is a kat. Kat means a unit of two witnesses. We need siruf kat. We need to join them together. This is going to be a major issue in the sugi that we're about to embark upon, when you have one witness who saw the crime from one vantage point, another from a different vantage point, and they didn't see each other. And that could mean that even if they come into Beis Din simultaneously as a group, they still do not form a kat, because we need siruf kat not only at the time of Haggadah, right, Haggadah, which means testimony, but also from the time of Re'iyah, from the time that they witnessed the crime. They have to be part of a group. Two of us saw something together. We saw it together in the sense that we both were aware, respectively, of each of the other person's presence to watch the crime happen.
I'm sorry, could you redefine again?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I should have erased a lot of things.
Kisan, siruf, what is that?
Siruf, this is a pay, this should be a pay sofit. Yeah. Siruf means litzaref. Litzaref means
the whole thing together.
And kisar means the absence of. So the absence of a connecting force. We need that what should I call it, an agent, what's it called in chemistry,
a catalyst.
We need a catalyst that will form one group. And if and chisar and siruf means that that catalyst, that agent is lacking, is missing. Now, at what point in time do we need that catalyst, that bonding the two witnesses into one group, into one God? We definitely need it at the time of the Haggadah. That's for sure. Then no one questions that when they come into Beis Din, they have to come in as a group, the two of them together. In fact, your mind will be boggled if you don't know this, that the two witnesses have to testify, let's say it like this, the second witness has to testify simultaneous with the first witness. That's ridiculous. That's impossible, right? So I said it in a very extreme way. Halachically, legally, in the Torah perspective, how do you create simultaneity? Tokenei dibur. So immediately when the first witness completes his testimony, without breathing, the second witness has to immediately begin telling his story. And that allows us to be mitzarif, the two of them, to a kat. That's called tziruf haggadah. So immediately when the first witness completes his story, immediately the second witness begins his story. However, there's one opinion, and we'll get to it in Mitzvah Shem either today or tomorrow, that tziruf requires tziruf re'ia. That means that even at the time when they witness the crime, they have to be aware of one another. They already began in the fledgling state, in the potential state, to create a kat. So now we have one witness who comes into Mitzvah. What's his status? He's possible.
Yeah.
Why? Because there's no possibility of tziruf kat in the Haggadah. The second witness is going to come in much later. And if you come in on your own, we don't accept long ranges here. It's either a kat or stay home. And don't even bother coming up to Beis Din. If you come into Beis Din, then you're a motzi shemra. You know, you're just trying to ruin someone's reputation. So that would be a case of a posel.
Oh, who was it?
The second one who walks in, the second aide, he's an Indian of Tziruf, yeah, Tziruf Kat. But he can't hear the first witness, can he?
You mean, is he able to be there when the witness gives his testimony?
Yes.
I don't know, I have to learn the laws of Vedas. My assumption is no, he's not in the room at that time.
Exactly.
Because we want to see if they're Mechuvenis.
Exactly.
Mechuvenis means if
exactly.
they both...
Exactly.
And therefore, well, I'm not sure if I understand. Oh, you mean how's he going to get to Tokenei Dibur?
Yeah.
Oh, that's what you're saying.
But I thought they do Drisha Chakira before. They already check before he gives the testimony.
Right. A lot of, you know, I gave you the extreme formulation where he starts his story immediately. There's a lot of things that go on in between. As soon as those things get finished, that's when he begins to give his testimony. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Wasn't there
Yossi?
Wasn't there a rabbi that totally just trashed out, I mean, the single witness who came in that we were talking about?
Yeah.
I mean, he turned it around and said, okay, you're now going to, I mean, he was...
Right. You're a motzi shemra. You're really slandering. I don't remember who it was, but we'll probably get to it here.
Yeah.
When we get to daf yud. So says Rabbi Akiva, what is this hekesh, this equation between two witnesses and three witnesses? Just like in the case of two witnesses. If one of the two witnesses turns out to be a karov or apostle, then quite clearly, and obviously we have to throw out the testimony, because we cannot have a testimony with less than two witnesses, is af shlosha, even if there's a third witness as part of the kat, nimtza echad meam karov apostle, a dusa b'tela, the third witness, turns out to be either a karov or apostle. Yeah, we have to figure out what apostle means in this context. And in such a case, we have to throw out the entire bunch. We called it yesterday, one bad apple spoils the bunch. U'minayin shafilu me'o, you have 100 witnesses, and one witness out of the 100 turns out to be a karov or apostle. Tamalomar edim. The word edim in this pasuk, shlosha edim, tells me no matter how many witnesses there are, the Torah could have said al pishnayim o shlosha edim, or could have said al pishnayim edim o shlosha. Why repeat the word edim twice? That becomes a superfluous word to teach me no matter how many witnesses there are, the same principle applies. And now we have to ask a number of questions. Question number one: is this rule of Rabbi Akiva absolute and applies to any Eidus? the context in which the Torah says Al Pishnayim O Shlosha Edim Yumas Hames might be understood as being limited to capital cases, because it says Yumas Hames. So obviously we're dealing with a case of condemning a person for a capital crime to death. The death penalty has this principle in which we equate 2 to 3. And if one of the three turns out to be a Karav Pasul, we throw out the entire kat. All this is a reflection of that concept that we wrote about, Tziruf Kat, that we join together this unit of testimony. But what about Dini Mominos? What about monetary law? Maybe the Torah in monetary law is willing to rely on 2 kosher Eidim, even if it turns out that the third extra Eid was a Karav or Apostle. That's one question that we have to address. And that's going to be immediately addressed by the Gemara. We have another question. And that is, what is Mitzaref these Eidim to a Kat? For example, let's say in a capital case, the third witness, we said, is part of the Kat. To such an extent that if he turns out to be a Karav Apostle, he ruins it for the entire Kat. Or the 100th witness, correct? Mm-hmm. What happens if that witness, the extra witness, whether he's number 3 or number 100 on the list, did not give a hasra? Is a hasra a precondition to what we call tziruf kat? Okay, now again, we're going to have to iron out all the nitty gritty details of these two questions, but let's start with the first question. Amar Rav Yossi, Bamed Dvarim Amurim. When does this principle of Nimtza Echadem Karav Apostle Edusam B'Teila, according to Rabbi Akiva, when does it apply? B'Dinei Nefashos. Because the Torah says, Yumas Hames. And the Torah is going to upgrade the requirements for Kosher Edim in the case of a capital crime. The Torah wants to find all the leniencies and all the technical disqualifications that are possible in order to spare someone's life. Which means that the Nidon is being accused for a capital crime, he will be condemned to death unless we can pinpoint some sort of disqualification of the testimony. And even if that disqualification becomes very dry, mechanical, and technical, for example, that one of the Eidim turns out to be a Karov or Apostle, nevertheless, the Torah says that will disqualify Torpedo the Eidus, and hence We're gonna have to throw out the witnesses and spare the life of the Nidon. The Torah is being overly compassionate by raising the ante on what would qualify as Eidim Ksherim, and that's called Lahakel. And that we said in the case of Azom, according to Rav Shimon, if you remember, that the Azom has to, you know, in the punishment of Kasher Zoma will only apply if all three witnesses turn out to be Eidim Zomimim. Here also we're applying a kula, according to Rav Yossi, that in the case at least of a death penalty, we're going to say that the Eidim will only qualify if every last one of the Eidim are qualified. But if one of them is disqualified, we're going to throw out the entire kat. Hence, we're going to spare the life of the accused. Avol b'dini mominos. When it comes to monetary law works within the framework of a more logical kind of set of rules and regulations. And logically, if we have 2 witnesses, and the Torah says the 2 witnesses are reliable in mominos, who cares if one of them, beyond the number 2, turns out to be an apostle, turns out to be a karo? And since the Torah in this hekesh of Shnayim L'Shlosha was talking about a case of Yumas Hames, therefore it is restrained. It's addressing only the case of a capital crime. Rav Yossi Omer, however, according to Rav Yossi, just one second, who's this Rav Yossi? Just one second. I'm sorry, Rebbe Omer, my mistake, my eye caught the wrong line. Rebbe Omer, that's Rav Yudah Nasi, in interpreting Rabbi Akiva's Hekesh, Echad Dine Mominos vi Echad Dine Nefashos. That we're going to extend and apply this principle of Nimtza Echad Mem Karav Apostle disqualifies the entire Kat, even to Dine Mominos. Why? Because we have an equation between Dine Nefashos and Dine Mominos. That the Torah says that That's called Dover Dover Mi Mamon. Al Pishnai made him Yakum Dover. It says in the parish of Mamon, and here it says Al Pishnai Moshlosha Edim Yakum Dover. You must a mess. And therefore, we're going to equate Dini Mamonis and Dini Nefashos. So the technical disqualification, if one of the witnesses, again, I call him a spare witness, meaning he's above and beyond the number two, it becomes clear that he is a Karav apostle, and now, therefore we disqualify the entire Kat, that applies even to Dini Mamonos. That's Rebbe Shit in Rebbe Akiva. Okay. You know, that means, by the way, if you're a Malveh, and you desperately need the testimony of two witnesses, you may have an intuitive sense, well, at the time of the Alfa, there were more than two people present. It might be in your vested interest to get as few witnesses as possible. Meaning, if you know that there are two witnesses who are definitely ksherim and they're not related in any shape or form, don't invite Moshe and Aaron in this case, then you should leave out all the other edim. The more witnesses that you subpoena into your kat, the greater the statistical probability or possibility of disqualifying the edim. So if you need this edim desperately, don't think, well, yeah, I'm going to really bamboozle the best. I mean, they're going to have no question in their minds about the veracity of what I'm claiming, because there are 100 guys who saw this happen. Well, you better think twice about that. Because if one of those 100 happens to be, you know, related to one of the litigants or one of the judges or so forth and so on, you know, you're in trouble. And we're going to have to throw out the entire bunch. That's according to Rebbe. Because Rebbe applies the principle of Rebbe Akiva and inside Efeb and Karfal even to Dine Nefashos, to Dine Mamas. Alright, now we get into another question. And that is, okay, Nimtza Echemem Kar Apostle. Let's take the case that's absolutely universally accepted. That is the case of Dine Nefashos. What makes each one of these Edim part of the Kat, such that one of them being Apostle will apostle the whole bunch? And the answer is, says Rebbe, Amosai, when is it considered Tzirif Pat? Bizman Shehisru Bahem. It means that the krovim, or the psulim, those witnesses who are technically disqualified, gave the asra to the over avera, to the person who was about to commit a capital crime. And in so doing, they indicated that they as witnesses, want to function in the role, in the capacity of witnesses, and therefore they establish themselves as part of, an integral part of the kat. Avol bizman shelo hisru bahen. If the eidim were just passively listening and watching, but without enunciating, they didn't open their mouths at all to give asra, then, and here we turn to Daf Tesam and Beis, we're going to assume, again, I'm going to fill in a little bit of the blanks here before we get to the Ma that's on the top of Daf Tesam and Beis. The blanks have to be filled in here. He says that Edim, who witnessed the crime, but they decided to play a passive role, and they did not actively offer a Hasra, they are not part of the Kat. And therefore, even if those that were silent turn out to be disqualified witnesses, either Karav or Apostle, so imagine, here's the case. You have three witnesses, and they're about to see a capital crime being performed. Two out of the witnesses give Hasra, and the third witness decides to be silent. Well, in this case, from the perspective of the Kiyum HaEdus, the Hechsher HaEdus, silence is golden. Why is silence golden? Because if it turns out that this third aid is a Karav Apostle, he's not going to spoil the Edus. He's not going to undermine and disqualify the Edus, because he himself didn't give Asra. He was silent. And that is a kind of a gilui. It's almost as if he revealed, he almost proclaimed that he's not part of the kat. Even though, again, at the end of the day, he showed up. See, as far as Haggadah is concerned, as far as Re'i is concerned, you have Tzirif Kat. But if there's a responsibility on the shoulders of the aid as an aid, as a witness, and he defaulted, he did not live up to that responsibility, then he's also out of Tziruf Kat. We now have a third halach of Tziruf Kat. We had the halach of Tziruf Kat in Re'iyah. We have halach of Tziruf Kat, a requirement in Agada. Both of those were fulfilled in this case. The third witness saw the testimony, saw the action that took place, and all the other witnesses know about him. So we have what's called Tziruf Re'iyah. Number two, he decided to show up in Beis Din, but there's something at the moment of the Re'iyah that reveals that he's not interested in being part of the Kat. He can change his mind, it doesn't matter. We need Tziruf Re'iyah. And the precondition for Tziruf Re'iyah is that you have to give what?
Warning.
A warning. That's your responsibility as a witness. Because if you don't give a responsibility, if you don't live up to that responsibility, give the Yasra, then what you're saying is that you're just watching the action, but you're not part of the process of bringing the violator to justice.
So what you're saying, you have a situation where you're coming over a hill, and as you come down the hill, two guys together, you see off in the distance, but close enough that you can actually see what's going on. All of a sudden, the guy's in the act. He's already in the act of bringing the axe down into the guy's head. You witness it. You see him kill the guy. But because I didn't blurt, because these two guys didn't say, no, don't do it, or something like that, they're puzzled.
Well, wait a second. I want to say this, Dan. Everything you said is true, and I like the drama, because I also like to be dramatic. But your comment is relevant even before this Gemara. Why? Forget about the third witness. Let's say there are two witnesses,
right,
and they didn't give Asra. You know, they got there just in time to see the axe, as you say, go into his...
That's okay.
He's off the hook. The Rotseach is off the hook. Again, I don't know if he's off the hook. I mean, there are other punishments that we could give him. You know, we might lock him into a solitary confinement. But as far as giving him Nisa is concerned, he's off the hook because there was no Asra.
Uh-huh.
It even goes beyond that, Don. I mean, they have to be... The Rotseach, the murderer, has to be Matir Atzmo L'misa. He even has to accept the Asra. He has to say, I know, and even so. You know, so all these technical. We're going a step further now. We're saying two out of the three witnesses got down the hill on time to give him Asra. The third witness came down the hill just in time to witness the murder, but not in time to give the Asra. He's off the hook if, but here it's conditional, if that third witness is a Karov or apostle. Wait, did I say that right?
No.
What's say?
No, sorry.
What I'm saying, if he's
becomes Karov Apostle.
Well, just one second. Again, if he didn't give a warning, according to Revi, if he did not give a warning, then he's Karov Apostle. Then the Eidah stands with the other two witnesses. With the other two witnesses, right? The others, yeah. That's not so upsetting, actually.
Okay.
That's not really such bad news.
If there's two or more witnesses, does each one have to give us?
Each one has to give us.
Either when it's given.
No. Well, maybe he could say amen or something like that. I don't know, but he has to give us raw. Exactly how we orchestrate that we'll get to the nitty gritty details. But each one has to give us raw. That's his responsibility, and that signs him up as a member of the Kat. Until he gives us raw, he's not signed up as a member of the Kat. Okay. Even though later on he decides to show up in Beis Din. And now the Gemara tries to prove this. Ma yasu shnei achim v'echad. So there are three witnesses to the crime. Two of them are brothers. Shero b'echad shaharigas ha-nefesh. Do you have the scenario, Don? Listen to this. Mm-hmm. Two witnesses who are brothers and a third witness who's not related. Mm-hmm. I would say, before this Gemara, Dad, forget it. There's no way you can condemn the criminal to death, even though he clearly, in the presence of three witnesses, committed this crime. But the problem is that two out of the three witnesses are related, which means that one out of the two brothers is absolutely disqualified. Now he's going to spoil the bunch. And the Gemara thinks that that's an impossible position. You can't tell me, says the Gemara, that if two brothers together with a third person saw the crime, the Ritzicha, that the Rotzech is going to be, by definition, exonerated. He's off the hook. Why? because one of the three is for sure apostle, meaning even though that one of the three is totally superfluous, I don't need him, drop one of the two brothers out of the picture, but the answer is that he witnessed the crime just like his brother did, so therefore he's part of the cat. If he's part of the cat, then we have a psul in the cat, then even though we have two Edom Kshayrim, the Rotzech is off the hook. Impossible. And therefore, says Rebbe, we're going to have to find some way, some mechanism by which we could be machshir this cat. And what we're going to do is we're going to tell one of the two brothers not to actively make asra. Again, you can't tell him not to show up. He was there at the scene of the crime. But we can advocate that he be silent. As I said before, silence is golden. And that removes him from the tzir of kat. Hence, even though he's a brother and he's an apostle, he's a karov, he would not spoil the bunch. And we could put the person to death.
Before or after you're telling him to do this?
You got to tell him beforehand. Before. Meaning, if he's not aware of this, if he thinks, well, my responsibility is to give asra, and he went ahead and he gave asra, then we're in trouble. Then the edus is thrown out. But if we can educate him beforehand, he's learning Masechet Sanhedrin like all the members of this class, so he's smart enough to know that according to Rebbe, in this case, he better be silent. Why? Because he's going to mess up the entire cat because he's related to one of the two Edom.
I just want to get a confusion out of my head. The difference between someone being posel and being part of the cat. All right. So in the case you gave, you have two brothers and the third one. So they're all part of, and they, unless say one of them, one brother didn't give a warning,
right,
and the other two did. So the one brother is not part of the cat, but he's right, not posel.
Well, again, the concept of psul it comes chronologically second. You know, the first we have to ask who's part of the cat.
Okay.
Once we establish who's part of the cat, then we're going to check each member of that cat, investigate his credentials, and see if one of them is possible. And if we find one of them to be possible, we throw out the entire cat. So our desperate situation here, because they're two brothers, is to make sure that one of those brothers is not part of the cat. So what do we advocate? We tell him, don't give asra. If you're not going to give that asra, you're not part of the cat. Hence, even though you would be possible, if you would be part of the cat, but you're not going to apostle a bunch because you're not. And keep in mind, this would apply, imagine the following scenario, you are 99 Edom, and then there's a man number 100, is also at the scene of the crime, but he's related to one of the other 99. So one of the 99 is his brother. Mm-hmm. If that be the case, we're going to have to throw out the entire cat unless we can exclude him from the cat and set up what we call chisar and siruf. How do we set up chisar and siruf, the absence of siruf? By advocating that he does not give the hasra.
Rashi says kasher in Bahem.
Right, no, there has to be one kosher. Rashi's talking about a case where you have three witnesses, right? So you have one who's kosher, he's not related to anybody. Then you have two brothers. Now you have three witnesses. Two out of the three are kosher in the sense that if we can knock off one of the two brothers, we now have two Edom Kshayrim.
Last question, I hope. So the guy who didn't give warning out of the three, mm-hmm, he's not psul, he's just not part of the cop.
Correct. Okay. Correct, because again, when you talk about a psul, that implies that he's a disqualified witness. Well, that means he's part of the cat. If he's not part of the cat, we couldn't care less whether he qualifies or not. He's just simply not part of the cat. Now, all this is according to Rebbe. But Rebbe Yossi disagrees with this. Rebbe Yossi holds that once these Edom, and two of them are brothers, saw the testimony, that's enough for Tziruf Kat. And therefore we're going to have to throw out these three. Mm-hmm. And Mayasu, you know, the question of Rebbe doesn't impress Rebbe Yossi. He says, Enochinami, in that scenario, you have three witnesses. We're going to see that Tosis is going to say, well, maybe one of the three witnesses, one of the two brothers, maybe he won't show up in Bezdin, and then we won't have the Tzir of Kad of Haggadah, if you follow what I mean. But basically, according to Rebbe Yossi, this is an impossible situation. Two brothers and one aide who's kosher. No way we could put the guy to death according to Rabbi Yossi, because nimtza echad mem karov apostle, the entire cat is possible. And even if he doesn't give the asra, he still, by definition, since he saw the event, is part of the cat. Okay, Rabbi Yossi, we're going to stop here.